Good morning, members. I'm calling Energy and Climate to order. We first have minutes from February 14th. Would somebody move approval of the minutes? Representative Stevenson?
I move approval of the minutes from our last meeting.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson moves approval of the February 14th minutes from February 14th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. We have two bills up today, members. To be fair, I am going to divide the time in half to make sure that we all get done. We will be voting on both bills, and so just in fairness, we'll divide the time in half. Representative Swazinski, did you have a question before we get started?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Just for a quick, just a quick question. You know, I know some of these bills kind of are related to the RDA and the RDE fund. Just was kind of wondering in general what the fund amount that is currently that's not encumbered in that, and then just also kind of the path of these bills. Are these bills going to be moving forward today? Or are they going to be laid over? And then I have just potentially one other question after that.
We can ask our fiscal analyst for just a ballpark amount that is in the fund right now.
Madam Chair, members, let me just grab the fund statement out.
Sorry about that. It was just a general question I had before we got started, kind of. And then just with the Ed bill, like, is that going to come out of energy, like from a pot of money, or will it come out of the Ed pot of money? As far as from a budget target standpoint, do you have a rough idea, Madam Chair, kind of where kind of the finance side is going to come? Is it going to be our money, or is it going to be Ed money, or you know that?
The budgets will be ours.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, for fiscal year 20, based on the November base, the February base will be coming out in a few days here. There is roughly $69 million in the renewable development account. If none of the funds were to be used in 21, it would be roughly $82 million.
Thank you.
With that, the first bill we have for consideration is House File 1133. This bill was referred to this division by the Chair of Ways and Means, Representative Carlson. Representative Acomb, if you would come up with your testifiers. And if you would move the bill, if moving House File 1133 be re-referred to the full committee with a recommendation that the bill be referred to the Education Finance Division.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, and thank you, members, for being here today. Do I need to make the motion you just said?
You can just repeat it, yes.
So can I move the motion that our chair just made. Can I do that?
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Welcome to the committee. I understand you have an author's amendment, and we can adopt that right now to put the bill in the shape that you would like it. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the amendment, and there's one amendment to the amendment I'd like to make as a verbal amendment. And in part of the bill talks about the eligibility requirements, and it says the capacity cannot exceed 120% or 1 megawatt. As stated now, it says whichever is greater. We'd like to change that to whichever is less. So kind of a little change, but makes a big difference. And so I appreciate those that pointed that out to us. So thank you.
That is on members. That is on line 2.31.
So thank you, Madam Chair.
We will move to the author's amendment. Do you have that amendment? Yes, whichever is less.
Mm-hmm. I believe it's in line 2.31.
Okay. So we're going to adopt your D1 amendment first, and then we will amend that amendment. So all of those in favor of the D1 amendment, E1 amendment, say aye.
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 Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. And then the amendment to the amendment would be on line 2.31. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. With that, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am pleased to be here this morning. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you all about the Solar on Schools bill. And this is a bill that really brings together two things that I'm very passionate about. The first is renewable energy, and in this case, solar energy. And the second is schools. And with the decrease in cost of solar, it has really made it more accessible to other applications. And so it's a great opportunity for schools to be able to take advantage of this. And Solar on Schools creates a new opportunity in education as well. I think that our schools are gathering places for many of us, not just students. And it allows the solar actually being on the school can allow a learning opportunity around new renewable energy and climate change. And that extends beyond just students to parents and grandparents and others that come into our schools, as they really are a focal point in our community. And so our bill is set up to provide grants through power purchase agreements through the Department of Commerce that will help stimulate solar energy in school districts. And to be clear, the grants cannot exceed a term of 20 years. And the solar will be either on the schools or in close proximity, very near, knowing that not all schools are set up the same. We wanted to leave a little bit of flexibility there, but it would be associated with the school. And the funds would be coming, all schools would be eligible to participate in this program. Those within the Xcel distribution area would use the renewable development account. And in Greater Minnesota, there would be funds from, and there's treats coming around, funds from the general fund. And so schools are a great opportunity for solar. Most of them have flat roofs, so it makes it very conducive. And these type of products can be, a grant like this can be a jump start to get a system or a program going statewide. And as I said before, talking about some of the opportunities around education and ways it can be implemented within the school. So I have a couple of people that are here with me today to help with some of the expertise. I have David Schaefer with Mincia and Eric Pace.
Posse,
yeah. Sorry. I'm better with first names than I am with last. And so they can kind of walk through some of the specifics.
If you would, Mr. Schaefer.
Yes, so I'm David Schaefer with the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We're a 501c6 nonprofit trade association. We represent about 115 different solar companies throughout the state of Minnesota. This includes installers, developers, and other interested parties in solar. Last year, there were two Solar on Schools bills, and we saw them get filed, and we just realized that this was an absolutely great idea. Schools have a very high energy usage, and this bill will allow them to offset a lot of that usage. My understanding is it's the second highest cost that schools have is energy. They have flat roofs. They're usually not shaded. And I think the most exciting part of this to me is I think it's just very good public policy. So the money effectively goes all the way through this big loop back into the pockets of the ratepayers and the taxpayers. So the way it works is the ratepayers, who are often Xcel customers, will put money into the renewable development account. The renewable development account parcels out the money to Commerce. Commerce gives a grant to the school, and then the school saves on energy, and that trickles back to the taxpayers, who are also the ratepayers. So really, this is a great way to take that renewable development account money and get it back to the people that initially invested it through the RDA process. So this is truly a win-win for everybody in the state, and it helps the students, it helps the faculty, it helps the building administrators, helps the taxpayers. and it helps the solar industry. So we really like that too. On top of that, there's a great educational opportunity. The schools that do currently have solar on their roofs, take their students up there to look at it. It's a great STEM curriculum activity. They have coursework where they can learn about how you take sun's rays and turn it into energy and capacity and deliver that back onto the grid. And through this bill, there will be requirements or suggestions to allow the metering to be visible so students can see that it's working, how it's working, and that solar is very useful. So all in all, this bill is a truly great thing for the state of Minnesota. For those, if there are any changes to the bills, we welcome all ideas for that because we think that this should be just something everyone agrees with. So with that, I guess I'll pass it on to Eric.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Eric Posse. I'm with a company called Innovative Power Systems, or IPS Solar. We are based out of Roseville, Minnesota. We're a solar development company and an installation company that does a lot of work with school districts. I started with the company in 2007, and right about 2012, we started to reach out to school districts as a and talk with them about putting solar on the roofs. This is a photo from Snail Lake Kindergarten in Shoreview, which is one of 13 installations that we've done with the Mounds View School District. We often are restricted on many of these projects to smaller 40 kilowatt systems. This was a Made in Minnesota project, and so as David alluded to, that money was coming from the RDA. The program is no longer available, and through a new Solar on Schools grant program would be a good supplement to that. So we were often seeing, we've got this kind of divide from what I would say is small solar, 40 kilowatt solar systems that we did on roofs, which is about 4,000 square feet, all the way up to community solar projects. And so this is a project that we did with the Red Wings School District, which is adjacent to their athletic fields, where we leased the space and installed a large 6-megawatt solar array. This is kind of a Goldilocks scenario where the school district had the area available, and we're not using that or planning to use that in the future, so we were able to lease it. So what that has done is left this pretty substantial gap between small solar arrays and larger ones. This is a typical installation at Twin Oaks Middle School, which is in the Prior Lake Savage School District. As you can see from the drone footage here, we have a 20 kilowatt system on the roof, and it's covering 2,000 square feet. This was provided through a grant by the Midwaukeeton Sioux community, and that was the only way that the district could move forward with the project. And as you can see, it's covering about 5% of the total available roof space. What this bill would provide is the opportunity to do more. Substantially more. And you can see that this system, although small, has a large environmental impact in saving 35,000 pounds of CO2 emissions over the course of 25 years. So the second part of what we do and what we offer with partnerships with schools is an educational component. This is also in the Mounds View School District. The gentleman in the center there, his name is Mike Cartwright, was one of our residential customers and was also a teacher at the school district and said, hey, there's an opportunity to bring learning to the classroom by using renewable energy. And really was a champion in that district. He actually was so moved by renewable energy that he took a one-year sabbatical to help us develop our solar curriculum. So when we partner with school districts, we provide learning opportunities and educator workshops. So what we do with our educator workshops is bring teachers in from that district or any district to come in and learn about how solar can impact students through STEM learning. And so kind of on this slide, on the right, we've got teachers that are coming out from the Red Wing School District to look at the solar that's actually on their property. In the middle, we had a kind of ribbon cutting with students from Twin Oaks School District. And so what solar can provide is real-time and historic data for teachers to compare and contrast, you know, what does irradiance do? What does temperature do to the output of these systems? Students can perform analyses that help them understand better the relationship between climate, weather, and energy. And so that's a obviously something that we're very passionate about, and an aspect of this bill that I think will be very popular is providing 21st century STEM learning opportunities for children on top of the substantial energy savings for the districts. Thank you.
Are there questions before we move to an amendment? I don't see any questions. There is the amendment DE1. Representative Swazinski is... A1 amendment?
With the author's amendment, I think it kind of changes it, so we're going to pull that amendment.
So there are no amendments. If there are no, we do have questions from members. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. I did have a question in regards to the current school projects you just discussed, and they seemed like a wide range of size, and I just had a question about how the schools decided on, you know, I know in Red Wing they had the land, that was obvious, but their system was huge compared to everything else, and I just wondered if that covers all the schools and more in Red Wing as far as their energy needs, and what percentage of energy needs are covered by maybe some of those other ones. Based on the size of their projects, and what impacted the decision on those smaller ones to proceed with solar, even though it clearly wasn't going to cover their needs.
Yep. So in relation to the Red Wing solar project, that is a community solar project, which I'm, you may be familiar from other bills that you've heard in the past. So it was... that was totally separate. So the district is participating in that project and other community solar projects. But again, it was kind of a Goldilocks scenario where they had the land, they weren't going to use it for anything. So the smaller projects were the impetus for school districts to move forward with those projects was based on really kind of taking a first step forward with renewable energy, and it was more of what I would call a pilot type projects because they aren't providing a substantial amount of electricity. Those 40 kilowatt projects are typically providing 5% or so of electricity needs for a school. And as you saw from in the example of Twin Oaks, which was about half of that, there's substantially more amount of roof space available for solar, but it was restricted due to the amount of incentive dollars that were available either through the Solar Rewards Program or through the Made in Minnesota program.
Okay. One quick follow-up, and it's more just a statement as far as a comment on some recent experience. I've had since the term started, I've had a public forum back in my district. I've had a meeting just in a coffee shop, and the number one and the number two issue are supporting schools and climate issues. And this fits in so nicely to what I'm hearing in my district that people want. And so when you combine the two, I think it's an ideal scenario. So supporting this bill supports school funding, and I just want to make that clear. The education piece, as you referred to it and talked about it, is ideal. I think it benefits the classroom learning, of course, and it's a good use of the fund that is available. So, I mean, like you said, it is a win-win-win, and it's what we need to do right now. So I wanted to thank Representative Acombe for bringing this forward and to tell you that of all the bills I dreamed of running with, this is it. So I applaud you for doing it, and thank you very much.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll end up with three questions here for now as I look through the bill. Question one, the county board in my district has been allowing solar to come in, but they have had some concerns regarding the cost for disposal of the panels at the end of their life. And so I'm wondering if there's any provisions or if you've considered any provisions for how those costs will be covered at the end of life.
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe. So currently we're working with the Pollution Control Agency on that topic. So these panels last 25 years. They're warrantied for probably 30. We're taking our time a little bit to make sure we get this right, and it seems like we got a lot of time to go. There are still some panels that were installed earlier. We're cognizant of that, so the clock's definitely not 25 years at this point, but it's something we're acutely aware of and we'd like to solve.
Okay, thank you. I have heard some estimates that are fairly expensive, and so obviously you don't want to leave anyone, you know, holding the bag with a whole lot of money to pay at the end of the life, so we want to make sure we cover that. Question number two. I noticed section 2.29, it talks about a power purchase agreement, and I'm wondering technically who buys that excess power when it goes back onto the grid, and how is the price determined for selling that excess power?
Sure. Thank you for that question. Excess power is purchased in XL Energy territory and all of the other investor-owned utility territories up to 1 megawatt at retail rates. In co-op territory, it does differ. They're only obligated to pay retail rates for excess power up to 40 kilowatts. So that is a disparity there. For most of the installations, even if we are filling an entire roof, we may only be covering 40 to 50 or 60% of consumption at a building. So there probably would be limited instances where those systems are actually selling back to the grid.
Is that actually a moving target where prices change based on need and with the grid and that sort of thing? So
average retail will float with inflation for energy prices or decline if should energy prices decrease. So that is pegged to the utilities rates at that time.
Thank you. And my third question, I don't see anything in here about a cap. Is there a maximum grant amount somewhere specified? I didn't see that in here anywhere.
Madam Chair, we don't have a cap per se, but it's based on their energy consumption and or the size of up to 1 megawatt. And Mr. Schaefer, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe, yeah, the price will be dictated by the Department of Commerce, who will make sure that the sizing is commensurate with the price, I guess. So it shouldn't result in one school getting billions of dollars or something, if you're concerned about that.
That makes me a little nervous because we don't know how much, and what if an opportunist suddenly is charging a lot more, you know what I mean? So there's a comfort level in knowing that there's a maximum amount out there. So thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, and maybe even Mr. Passi, you can speak to the average cost of an installation for schools with the average size and the cost mm-hmm. per school.
Yeah, so for most of the projects that we've modeled or done, an average school may be able to hold about 300 kilowatts, which is about 30,000 or so square feet. The cost of that type of system might be somewhere around $500,000 to $550,000. When I was looking at the math, if there were $32 million that were provided into the fund, that would result in roughly 250 schools being able to adopt solar at 300 kilowatts.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does your bill allow for solar thermal?
Madam Chair. Mr. Schaefer, are you?
One second.
I think it does. It's a good question.
I know it is.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, maybe. I don't know.
I just did a quick read, and it doesn't appear as though. And although we all use electricity, it's probably one of the worst exchanges from solar photovoltaic to heat is probably negates the whole purpose of it all. But solar thermal is cheaper to install, less maintenance, and you don't use as much natural gas. So, thank you.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of a couple questions. Are private schools eligible?
I believe we are looking at public schools.
Okay. And then just kind of a follow-up. Why are we focusing in on solar? We have other renewable options. We have small hydro. We have wind. Why is there the focus on a particular type of renewable instead of just maybe allowing school districts to decide what might work best for them?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a good question. I think there's many areas in the bill that we wanted to allow some flexibility with oversight from the Department of Commerce. I think we picked solar because of I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Schaefer and see if he can provide a little clarity.
Yeah, sure. Representative Swazinski. So I don't want to disparage the other types of renewables, but in general, when you're putting stuff on buildings, probably the easiest and best way to do it these days are sort of through efficiency and through solar. I think the next bill is on efficiency, so that's sort of that direction. Wind, there were turbines available that were kind of in that small space, but efficiencies in wind double, my understanding. Every time you double the wind blade length, you get exponential energy growth from it. So that particular sector has been growing towards bigger and bigger turbines as opposed to smaller and smaller ones. Right now, solar, to my knowledge, is beating wind turbines for residential commercial use generally, so on pricing. So really, and hydro, I don't know that there's that many places you could do that, I guess. But so to my knowledge, really the two viable options for commercial buildings are efficiency measures and solar.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just let's say I'm school district XYZ, walk with me. Say I've got a school board that's supportive or whatnot. How would this just walk me through the process a little bit on how this potentially would move forward?
Maybe since you know a little bit more about the power purchase agreement, you can speak to that, Mr. Schaefer.
Sure, yeah. Representative Swazinski, my understanding of how this would work, the school reaches out to a solar installer developer, says, hey, we want to go solar. The developer would then take the school's application and say, okay, well, how much money do you actually need to do this? Do you have any money you can contribute? If not, then we'll say that there's kind of a need-based approach to this too. Then that application is filed by the solar developer with all the pertinent information to the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce would then work with the solar developer to determine what the best PPA terms are for this. The purpose of the PPA is solar works really well with the investment tax credit on private businesses, not as well necessarily on public businesses because they don't have a big of a tax burden. So this is a way for the schools to take advantage of that 30% investment tax credit. So through this PPA model, the Department of Commerce would basically allocate certain dollar amounts for the contract period so that this other third-party entity that owns the array for a little bit can get paid back, and then they flip it over to the school at the end through a final payment in the PPA process. So it's a little complicated, but the purpose of it is to basically save the ratepayers and the taxpayers 30% by using the ITC.
So if I understand you right, so the investor will own it for a majority of its span, and then towards the end it flips it back to the school district?
Representative Swazinski, not the majority, no. I think the payback period we're expecting is like in the 5 to 10 year range. They're warrantied for 25, and they usually go another 5. So a little less than a third of the life will be in this private entity's hand.
Madam Chair, so the school district will be able to apply for the 30% tax credit, or will the investor be able to? How does
Representative Swazinski? Yeah, the The financier will apply for the tax credit, but presumably if there's a competitive market out there, in order to make this work, those that'll be passed on to the schools.
So, Madam Chair, so school districts by and large are exempt from sales tax. Will they pay sales tax on these particular projects in your history of doing them in Prior Lake and others? Are the local taxpayers on the hook for sales tax?
Representative Swedinski.
It's okay.
Sorry. thank you for that question. I'm a little slow this morning. Apologize. Sales tax, solar sales tax exempt as well. And so there is an alignment there, both with a district not having to pay sales taxes as well as solar being exempt from sales tax.
All right. I think that's all I have for now, Madam Chair. So,
thank you. Representative Mecklen and then Representative Long, and then we'll see if there are folks who would like to testify from the public.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up on a question that Representative Bull asked about the end of life for the panels. To that, is there any kind of surety bond that is put in place? Because if you don't know what the cost would be and you're working on that, is there some form of surety bond that's being purchased currently to protect the schools and or anybody with these panels going forward?
Thank you for the question, Representative. So for community solar projects, we always post, well, I shouldn't say always, but significantly most of the time we are posting surety bonds because we are actually leasing the project space from a landowner, and we want to avoid a situation where the landowner has an obligation to recycle this equipment at the end of life. For power purchase agreements with school districts where the system actually, the ownership transfers to the school, those surety bonds are not typically required. But as David alluded to earlier, we are looking at, you know, working with the PCA and looking at what is the most economical and safe solution to disposing of this equipment at the end of life. One thing that I might add is that at the end of the lifespan for these panels, assuming that technology continues to advance, a new solar technology developer at that time or the school district may elect to install equipment to replace that solar array. And we have been seeing that, you know, as a requirement to doing business, the new developer would then recycle or dispose of that equipment.
Thank you. One more question, Madam Chair. And I'm not really sure who would answer this, but it says in here that the Department of Commerce can take administrative cost. So to that, who determines what costs are reasonable, and do we know what those costs are?
I'll let Mr. Schaefer answer that one.
Representative Mecklen, I think that would be a Department of Commerce question. I'm sure that they have sort of historic numbers that they can look to. One that comes to mind is there was this program that existed, Made in Minnesota. I think they're even going to use maybe some of the same employees to do it. So I would guess it would basically be the cost of just the staff and maybe some general administrative things. But if they're here, perhaps they're the better people to ask.
Thank you.
Representative Long, and then we will go to public testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a couple of questions that have been asked about how the Department of Commerce would respond to some of the language in the bill. We have our deputy director here. I'm just wondering if Joe Sullivan might be interested in making a couple of remarks in response.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Commerce has not received a request for a fiscal note on the bill yet, but as soon as we do, we will put that together and we can break out those administrative costs and how we arrived at those for you. So, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions if there are any.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one question, Deputy Director Sullivan, was on how the department would look at coming at the amount or of each individual grant that would be given out, and whether there would be some natural limit on what a particular project might be getting, if that's something you are prepared to respond to based on some of the other work the Department of Commerce is doing.
Madam Chair, Representative Long, I wouldn't want to get into the kind of the granularity of it, but I we would develop a process and a formula for how we would structure that. And, you know, we could, later today or within the next couple of days, let the committee know how exactly we would derive that. But I'd be happy to put that together for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the last question I have is for our other two speakers. Just curious about the level of savings that you've seen for school districts that have installed these and what the decrease has been in some of their energy bills.
Thank you, Representative Long. I think Eric's got some great information about that. We talked about it earlier.
Madam Chair, Representative Long. For these types of projects, I think we were talking about 300 kilowatts being a average system size. At that size or a scale, savings probably range in the $40,000 per year range. During the power purchase agreement period, the majority of those savings would be paid back to the developer to pay off the system cost. But over the 25-year period, just kind of running some rough back-of-the-envelope calculations, savings for an individual school, for one school with 300 kilowatts, could be up to $500,000.
Thank you. Representative Kaczynski, do you have a quick question?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. Just a kind of a follow-up. We talked a little bit about the adjacency to the project to the school. Could potentially these grant dollars be used to buy into a community solar project?
Madam Chair and Representative, no.
Okay, and then just one follow-up question to that. On line 3.1 of the DE amendment, it talks about the commissioner shall design a power agreement, but then on line 4.19, it says a copy of the proposed shall be between a school district and an investor. Like, is it do they need to provide one, or can it go either way? Can the school district and the developer design a purchase agreement, or does the commissioner need to do that?
If I understand you correctly, Representative, I think that, as my understanding, the power purchase agreement will be developed through the Department of Commerce and administered through them between the school and the investor.
Okay. Will the utilities be consulted on that at all, or?
I'm not sure. I guess I hadn't. And I think I was actually approached by a utility yesterday, and I think the utilities could be potentially an investor as well, could they not? So there's every opportunity for their involvement.
Mr. Sullivan may want to answer that question.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, the goal with the development of a standardized agreement is that it would be simple for the schools, so that would be what we would hope to achieve. Through how the program gets structured, we could certainly look at, you know, giving schools and school districts the option to, structure it, their own way. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to eliminate that flexibility from the program design, and we can absolutely, talk about how we structure that. As to the involvement of the utilities, I think that we have to talk more with the utilities, but I think it'll be a stronger program if the utilities can work through this program. So,
okay. Thank you. Thank you for that. I think right now we're going to hear from the public, and six people have signed up to testify, and given the time, and we are going to make sure we have time to vote on both bills. If folks would limit their testimony to 2 minutes apiece. The first is Andy Snow. With Rob Scott Hovland ready to testify immediately thereafter. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak. My name is Andy Snope. I'm the Legislative Director for the IBEW, Minnesota State Council. They represent 16 IBEW local unions, 16,000 IBEW members in all aspects of the electrical industry, in the production, distribution, delivery, and utilization of electricity. We don't just advocate for union members. We advocate for all workers in the electrical industry, for higher wages and better working conditions. IBW members attend 6 apprenticeship training programs in the state offering training in the electrical industry for apprentice and journey workers in the electrical construction as well as the electrical transmission industry. We have an interest to see an economy that's moving forward towards renewable energy become an economy that is beneficial to everyone's economic well-being, especially the worker. Workers' financial well-being and security drive a strong economy. We want to thank Innovative Power Solutions for being a contractor that respects the well-being of their employees by paying good wages and benefits and recognizing the training and skill of an IBW workforce. Over the past years, as this country has shifted its reliance of energy production from legacy energy production to renewable energy production, the IBW has seen some concerning trends. We have seen a loss in high wage and benefited jobs in the legacy energy production market be diminished, while not seeing those job opportunities being replaced by equally paying jobs in the renewable market production. While, of course, there has been a large influx of job creation in the production of renewable energy, we have not always seen quality, sustainable, high wage and benefited jobs created equal to those jobs that are being lost. I think we can continue to do better in Minnesota. The IBW wants to support the move to renewable energy production, but we would like to see better incentives and guarantees that the jobs that are created are good jobs. For that reason, we are asking that the author of House File 1133, the Solar on Schools bill, to work with us to include a prevailing wage language for the work that is created through the offerings of these grants to put more solar on schools. We believe that an economy built on electrical production renewables brought about by increased incentives and mandates towards renewables should also include requirements for economic assurances for workers who help build and maintain these renewable energy systems. Requiring prevailing wage on these projects is a start towards that promise of building a strong economy for all workers in the renewable energy production field. Thank you for allowing me time to speak.
Thank you so much. Rob Scott Hovland, please. And then next, Rick Evans. Please limit your testimony to 2 minutes.
Good morning. Thank you for, good morning, Representative Wagenius and members of the committee. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify on House File 1133 today. I represent Missouri River Energy Services, a municipal power agency that provides wholesale power to 61 municipal electric utilities in 4 states. 25 of those members are located here in Minnesota. Missouri River and its member electric utilities are not-for-profit, customer-owned, and customer-operated. We agree with the intent of this bill to provide schools grant funding for solar demonstration projects and the creation of a solar curriculum. We disagree with making third-party developers the only pathway to implement those grants and with tasking the Department of Commerce with the management of those relationships. Municipal electric utilities are owned and regulated by the customers they serve. To that end, municipal electric utilities make long-term investments in generation and distribution to supply the needs of those communities. Those decisions and investments are made to ensure the safety and reliability of all of our customers. Schools located within our communities are a part of that decision-making process. Literally, they are owners of the electric utilities that provide their power. One of our concerns with this bill is that it interjects a developer between the school and the utilities that they own. We believe that this would violate existing Minnesota State Service Territory Law. Service Territory Laws provide that a utility must serve all customers within its assigned service territory. And this includes not only providing electricity to all customers, but also providing services such as energy efficiency programs, committing to laws that comply for the cold weather rule disconnects, and bill repayment programs. By requiring utilities to serve in a set area and not allowing another entity to serve electricity in that same area, municipal electric utilities are able to review and predict their customer owner needs, goals, and make long-term investments in infrastructure, distribution, transmission, and generation to serve their individual communities. We oppose the portion of the bill that would interfere with this established law. Additionally, we have some concerns that the fact that the bill tasks the Department of Commerce with developing contracts including some certain aspects of setting rates. This would grant the Department of Commerce rate-making authority over municipalities and cooperatives, which are rate-regulated by the customers that they serve, including their schools. Missouri River Energy Services have invested heavily in both energy conservation programs and renewable energy. Yearly, we budget about $4.5 million for our members' customers to invest in energy efficiency. We will continue to work with our schools to invest in lighting retrofits, HVAC improvements, and new construction design. We would welcome the opportunity to work with our utilities on solar installations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick Evans. And next up, Kent Sulem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about the bill today. Let me say at the outset that we had a brief conversation with Representative Akam yesterday and look forward to working with her because we believe that there is a way to accomplish the goals that she set out in this bill. But at the same time, we have some serious concerns about the way that this particular bill is put together, and we look forward to working with the committee as well as Representative Akam on this. In order to put my remarks in some context, I need to talk just for a minute about what public utilities are, because public utilities are set up in Minnesota statutes for a very particular reason. The idea of a public utility is that every Minnesotan has a right to universal access to electric service, and they have a right to fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory rates. Excuse me. In order to accomplish those goals, we have set up what we in the utility business like to call, the regulatory compact. The regulatory compact is the deal that we have with the state of Minnesota that says utilities get to serve, get to have exclusive service territory. Yes, we have a monopoly on the customers in our service territory. But there's another side to that bargain, and that is, the other side of the bargain is that we have an obligation to serve every one of those people in our service territory. We cannot tell someone you're too expensive to serve, we don't have time to serve you. We have an obligation to provide 100% of the energy that 100% of our customers need 100% of the time, and to do that with fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory rates. We do that by providing transmission, distribution, backup power, that is the power plants that we own that hardly ever run, but they run on that hot August afternoon when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining. We have an obligation to provide all of those things, and because of the structure of public utilities in Minnesota law, we pay for those things with a blended rate, a rate that is socialized over all of our customers, established by the Public Utilities Commission to make sure that they're fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory. This bill, for the very first time to my knowledge, allows a third-party, unregulated, for-profit company to come in and sell energy to customers within the exclusive service territory. They have no obligation to pay for transmission. They have no obligation to pay for distribution. They have no obligation to pay for backup power. All they sell is energy, and they will lean on the public utilities to provide all of those things that they're not willing to pay for. That provides two problems with this bill. And I realize I'm out of time, but I want to make sure that the committee understands the problems and how assure you that we think we can address most of them. By allowing a third-party seller to come in and an unregulated for-profit company and sell energy to our customers undermines the entire public utility structure that is there to guarantee universal access, fair, and non-discriminatory rates. That's problem number one. Problem number two is it creates a privileged customer. A customer that is able to take advantage of purchasing energy without making the contribution to the transmission, distribution, backup power, conservation programs, low-income programs, and all of the other things that are built into the rates that public utilities charge.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We will have, this bill will come back to this committee, assuming that the Department Ed Finance approves it. They will send it back here. We will have additional time to talk about this bill.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Councilwoman? You have 2 minutes. We are going to vote on both of these bills today.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulum, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I will echo the comments made by the preceding two speakers. I think this bill has got very good aspirations, but the structure just doesn't work and threatens your local municipal utilities and the existing regulatory process. In particular, our concerns are, as mentioned, the Department of Commerce having rate authority, not taking into account the process that we have to use when working with our residents. I want to assure you that as a municipal utility, we are working very hard to promote solar and other renewables. We actually have a meeting scheduled on Friday with a number of stakeholders that have been working on SIP reform, and part of our SIP reform is trying to develop the school process to allow the local utilities to partner more closely with the schools and come up perhaps with a joint application. It would be an ideal situation where it's kept at the local level between the utility and the school versus having a third party that, as Mr. Evans indicated, starts changing everything that we've ever worked under. So thank you.
Lauren Lutag and then Thor Underdahl. And that will end our testimony, and then Representative Acom will renew her motion.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lauren Lantug with Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. We serve electric customers in western Minnesota and in the eastern Dakotas. Otter Tail Power already is doing small solar with schools, and we have something called a publicly owned property solar program. It's provided for in an existing statute, 216B.241, the SIP or Energy Conservation Statute. Subdivision A allows utilities to do small solar with various entities. So we've invented a public entity program. We rebate customers the equivalent of up to 40% of their cost. The reason we do that is public entities typically aren't eligible for solar for the investment tax credit under the IRS codes. So we provide them with up to a 40% rebate. We've done projects at the University of Minnesota Crookston. They have a 20 kilowatt solar project. At the University of Minnesota Morris, they have 3 40 kilowatt projects. The Morris High School is doing a 7 kilowatt project this year. In Cass Lake, Minnesota, near Bemidji, the Leech Lake Government Center is doing a 40 kilowatt project last year. And finally, the public broadcasting station in Bemidji, Lakeland PBS, did a 40-kilowatt system last year. Again, this is all under our existing small solar program. My suggestions with respect to House File 1133, the DE1, would be instead of creating an all-new section of statute, 216C.375, and instead of creating an all-new program with all-new financing accounts, third-party owners, the participants in our program, own their own solar. So the Lakeland Public Broadcasting Center owns its solar system. And set of formulas for future market value, escalators every so often, application processes, adjustments for rate of return every 5 years. And instead of limiting it only to schools, I would suggest that if you feel compelled to do more small solar, there's an existing section of statute which would accommodate this very nicely. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Thor Underdahl. 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thor Underdahl with Minnesota Power. Appreciate having a few minutes to speak to this bill, and appreciate the author for bringing it forward. I won't reiterate what's already been said. We're very supportive of encouraging our schools to engage in conservation, energy efficiency, and solar projects. Through our Solar Sense rebate program,
We provided rebates for solar projects at Cuyuna Range Elementary School, Cohasset, UMD, Duluth Public Schools, Montessori School of Duluth, and Mini Rivers Montessori. So we have a track record of doing this, and I think we can continue to do it as we work on this bill. We also regularly present at teacher workshops at the Boulder Lake Environmental Center to provide learning opportunities for area teachers on the topic of renewable energy. So we fully appreciate the advantage of the hands-on learning that it's created when you're able to get in front of this and get it in front of our educators and our students. We do want to work on the elements that I think others have spoken to make sure that this bill aligns with and facilitates a solar transaction that works within the regulatory framework that currently exists, and I think there's ways to do that. And secondly, you know, we would like to see opportunities for schools to continue to partner with utilities. We have great relationships with our schools. We're to many of them are the trusted energy advisor that they can look to do their energy efficiency, their conservation, their renewables. So we hope that we can play a role in this space as well, too, and continue to work on the bill. But thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Representative Swasinski, if you have a quick comment.
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair. Just kind of pending some of the testimony and just kind of the nature of this bill and what it could potentially do to the grid as a whole and the responsibilities and how it really throws a wrench. And I really don't believe this bill is ready for prime time. I think it has a good aspiration. That's not saying anything against you. But the bill does concern me very much so. And I would just, I think, you know, the chair has said this bill could potentially come back here. I really don't think it should leave until it's ready for prime time. And I would just ask the committee to, and I move to table the bill. So, thank you.
That is not a debatable motion. We will vote, and the chair would say that we vote no. All those in favor of Representative Swasinski's motion, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
No. Is not tabled. Representative Ecombe renews her motion that House File 1133, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that the bill be re-referred to the Education Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? The bill will be re-referred. Thank you. Representative Christensen. And if you would bring up your testifiers, Jamie Fritzky and Matt Sapit. Again, House File 1148 was referred to this division by the Chair of Ways and Means Committee, Representative Carlson. Representative Christensen moves that House File 1148 be re-referred to the full committee with a recommendation that the bill be referred to the Education Finance Division. Representative Christensen, welcome to the committee. I understand you have two author's amendments. Let's start with the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form that you would like it. Would you just move that amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the A1 amendment be adopted.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? Is adopted. And then we have the A3 amendment. A2. Again.
A2.
Oh, I'm sorry. A2 amendment to get the bill into the shape that the author would like it. All those in, would you move that amendment, please?
I move the A2 amendment.
Thank you. All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? The bill is in the form that the author would like it. And so Representative Christensen, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. And thank you, everyone, for coming. I have a lot of folks from my school district here today, and I'm so proud to say that. Just raise your hands. And yeah, lots of people from my school district today. I'm a retired teacher, and so they make me proud. I'm here today to introduce a bill about a revolving loan fund for schools. Schools have limited budgets, and helping them to become more energy efficient not only saves money that can be used to give our kids and our students education they deserve, it can be used to teach them that something can and is being done. It can be education that is real instead of educating to standardized tests. In turn, I also think that, you know, providing conservation efforts in schools will spread to the community. I think it's an important thing to do within the community. Spending on energy is the second biggest cost the schools have. Inefficient schools use 3 times more energy than efficient schools. A typical elementary school spends $60,000 a year on energy costs. An average high school spends $130,000 a year. If 20% of that cost is lighting, and those costs can be reduced by 50%, and they can, through efficient lighting, an average-sized elementary school would save $6,000 a year, and an average high school $13,000 a year. The Center for Energy and the Environment estimates that 70% of our schools in Minnesota have lighting efficiency opportunities. Most schools could save at least 25% on energy costs with efficiency, often much more. With more than 3,000 school buildings in Minnesota, the savings from wasted energy adds up. Schools in Minnesota spend $200 million a year on electricity. I know my school district is looking for cost savings and ways to save money. Many schools cannot afford to make the initial investment to initiate good conservation projects. The payback is 3 years for changing to efficient lighting and 15 years for upgraded HVAC systems. Money-strapped schools would benefit from the upfront assistance to invest in energy efficiency and cost savings. A typical Minnesota elementary school, I already said that, okay. So I'd like to introduce HF 1148, please. It creates a revolving loan fund to provide low-cost funds for school districts, and they can use that to make energy conservation investments to lower energy costs. The loans would be made below the market rate of interest for terms of up to 15 years. In 2020, $8 million is appropriated from the Renewable Energy Fund to assist school districts within the XL territory, and $8 million from the General Fund for districts outside of the XL area. The Commerce Commissioner will manage the program. And with that, I'd like to introduce Jamie, and she will introduce herself.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Wagenius, Representative Christensen, and members of the Energy Committee. I'm Jamie Fitzke, speaking on behalf of the Center for Energy and Environment. Our mission is to promote energy efficiency to strengthen the economy while improving the environment. We have extensive expertise in energy efficiency and in providing schools with energy analysis and efficiency recommendations. CEE supports this bill as it would provide a financial tool for school districts to implement energy efficiency measures. Typically, I'd launch into all the economic reasons to support energy efficiency, though Representative Christensen has done a great job in highlighting those benefits. Instead, I'll take a moment to highlight the benefits students would receive from this. A good learning environment improves student engagement. Light levels and spacing designed for how classrooms operate today to read whiteboards and computer screens, not chalkboards. This enables children to see better, reduces eye fatigue, and improves concentration. Research from Lawrence Berkeley National Labs finds that students' health is affected by HVAC systems and indoor air quality. High-performing systems can limit the presence of air toxins, mold, and run quieter for fewer distractions. And as Representative Christensen spoke to, the economics make sense. The lighting example she provided would result in average lifetime savings for the average elementary school of $100,000. An average high school would have lifetime savings of that lighting measure. They would save $200,000. Now, with more than 3,000 school buildings in Minnesota, the savings from wasted energy adds up. So why aren't schools implementing energy efficiency? Some schools may lack information on the type of efficiency they could benefit from. But more often than not, the cost of implementing energy efficiency improvements are the barrier, and resources are finite for public schools. Some more fortunate districts are able to access capital improvements or health and safety funds to make the improvements. Other districts attempt to make incremental or piecemeal improvements as the systems fail. Though many school districts just don't have the resources to make these changes. I commend the schools that have made energy efficiency improvements. This bill provides schools across the state to have the same opportunity. Thank you for allowing me to speak in favor of this bill. And now I'll introduce Matt.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Matt Stupnik, and my company is Cedar Creek Energy. And we are electrical and general contractors, and we're located in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. We're in Representative Stevenson's district. We've been in business 12 years, and our main thing we do is implement solar and energy efficiency at commercial buildings, and the commercial buildings include schools. And one of the biggest challenges we see is that there is no money available for schools to do clean energy projects, and in particular, energy efficiency. The last school district we did down in the Southwest happened to be in XL Energy territory, so it made it a little bit easier because Center for Energy were able to work with, but most schools do not have this type of access. And so what we see is we see large savings. We'll go and implement the project, and then we come back and audit it by looking at the bills. You're seeing 500,000 kilowatt hour savings per year at this particular location with five separate schools. But as soon as we step out into the outstate area, for instance, the level of being able to do these projects and come up with the funding, it just doesn't exist. There's a big difference between the outstate schools and the in-state schools. And by doing this, energy efficiency is the least expensive out of anything. So if we look at distributed generation, if we look at power plants, just making it efficient where you're using it is the best way to spend the money. And also, if you look at the way a school runs, it's running 9 months out of the year. It's vacant, you know, right 3 months out of the year. So just having smart technology to know that people aren't in the spaces and lights are getting shut off. A big thing is the lighting. That is one of the bigger things, and obviously mechanicals, roofing, so on and so forth. What we see is it's about 2 cents to save. It's 2 cents per kilowatt hour on energy efficiency. So if the school is going to be paying, say, 10 cents blended, which is probably very conservative, that's a large savings. So instead of paying the utility company four times more for this public service, which are our schools, wouldn't it be better to put our money right at the source versus sending it to a power plant, having them send it back? So then if they do pay a higher price, what happens? The levies go up, or the levy gets rejected. Right? So that's what you're seeing, is you're seeing disparities between these large schools that have money, and you're seeing it with schools that don't have money. We were fortunate enough to get this one particular project done because we had third-party financing and we had third-party options. And the Center for Energy would come in, and we partner with them, and they spec it out. So, you know, a lot of people talk about efficiency and distributed generation. We're just spreading the savings out to everyone versus keeping it at the top. So we can keep it at the top, but the system's changing. The system is changing. And whether utilities want to see that or not, I think they realize that's really what's going on. They just want to protect their interests versus spreading it out to everybody else. Thank you.
Representative Spaczynski has a question for you.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a general question. Do we have a fiscal note on this bill at all, or has one been?
We don't. We will be asking for fiscal notes by the time, again, I expect this bill to go to Education Finance. If it comes back to us, we will have one by then.
All right. Well, and then kind of the same type of question. If it's going to Ed Finance, will the finance portion of this bill come out of their budget or?
This one.
This one will? Okay. All right. And then just another question. So when we're talking energy efficiency, essentially, will local utilities be able to count any energy savings because of this bill part of their mandate?
I don't believe that is incorporated into this bill. Perhaps somebody else could answer that question.
Madam Chair, Representative Spaczynski, I believe the intent of this bill is to ensure that savings would go towards the SIP programs and the requirements for utilities to meet those energy efficiency goals. I believe that is the intent.
So Madam Chair, so just to understand it, thank you for all the students and that for coming. So it would count, so the utilities would be able to, so if this dollar, you know, $8 million is spent in a bunch of schools, the local utilities would be able to count those energy savings towards their goals overall?
Absolutely. Sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski.
Let's have council help us out with that answer because of the way the bill is written. If council could help us.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, the bill is actually silent on that matter. I think under those conditions, under the fact that it is silent, it would depend on whether or not the utility was involved in some of this program.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if we have rules. Would the author, if we could talk about this to get an amendment so that it would count, so energy savings is energy savings, and we allow one mandate to help another, would the chair or the author of the bill be open to an oral amendment along those lines?
We will not have an oral amendment today, but we will have an opportunity when the bill comes back and we can discuss it in the meantime between the author and council and other people who would like to weigh in, but we're not going to do that today.
And just one more follow-up. Just, with the solar previous bill, those things are tax exempt from a sales tax point of view, but I know for one thing, if a lump sum contract is done within a school, which my guess is that's how you operate as a contractor, the school board isn't approving which 2x4 or insulation bat. Would you be open to allowing the things that are purchased to be sales tax exempt? So if you're putting insulation in or replacing windows for that local school district, ultimately that's going to get either passed on through the grant or the loan, and then ultimately onto the local property taxpayers. I think that would be a great incorporation into this bill, so that local school districts aren't paying sales tax on that new window or whatever that might lead to more energy efficiency or the new lights. Any comments from
I would just say they have a sales tax exemption form then. So when we're buying it wholesale, we're not charging the sales tax for that particular product. But for a for-profit business, we are, right? Depending on the city rate and the county rate.
Okay. That answers that.
And then solar outright is just tax exempt.
Representative Bowe, and then did you? Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Christensen. I do want to say I want to applaud your efforts. I think any time we can put effort into conservation, that just makes so much more sense rather than putting money into more infrastructure and everything else to try to realize a savings or a reduction in use. If we can do it out front with conservation, that makes sense. But as I look through this, one thing is missing, and I'm wondering, can the Department of Commerce charge a fee to administer and oversee the program, the revolving fund, and if so, how much?
Mr. Sullivan, could you speak to that, please? Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe, my understanding is that since we have not had a fiscal note requested yet, when we do, we can make that determination at that point to determine, how it would be structured.
So there really isn't anything now. We'll have to kind of wait and see how it goes.
Excuse me?
So it doesn't specify one way or another for now. That'll be something we'll talk about as we move forward further into it.
Madam Chair, Representative Bowe, correct to my understanding.
That's Thank correct. You. Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions for members? If not, are there folks in the public, in the audience, who would like to testify for or against this bill? We didn't have anybody sign up this, and our normal procedure is to have people sign up. We put that out with a notice, but nobody has signed up. All right. No other questions? Representative, I see no further discussion. Representative Christensen renews her motion that House File 1148, as amended, be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that the bill be referred to the Education Finance Division. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? We'll go to
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you all for coming. I appreciate that. There is no further business before the committee, and the meeting is adjourned.